Welcome to Still Untitled, the Adam Savage Project. I'm Will.
I'm Norm.
Adam's gone, but we have Ariel here.
Ariel Waldman.
Yeah.
How are you doing?
I'm doing awesome. How are you?
We're doing good. This is a surprise recording. We didn't expect to record this episode with Adam last week.
He's abandoned us.
He is on a well-deserved vacation, traveling the earth with family and his dogs. If you follow him on Twitter, he's shown pictures of him in the car with the dogs. But we are still using the cave because all this week we were doing this Twitch live stream event, and we're filming some of our favorite things. And of course, we wanted to check in with you, Ariel. We thought it would be a perfect time to hear about your adventures because you were recently in a fantastical place. Tell us, where were you for how long?
I was in Antarctica and for 5 weeks.
Wow.
You're the second person we know now that I think they've lived for an extensive period on McMurdo.
Who's the other person?
A friend of the site, Phil Broughton, who is runs the blog Funranium Labs and makes Black Butt of the Earth, did a winter at the South Pole, I think, like thing style, as a bartender / staff member.
That's pretty awesome.
He had a lot of, like, he sounded kind of like, I mean, he might have been a janitor. I think what you were doing is a little more sciencey. So I'm really curious, like, first off, like, how does one get to go to Antarctica?
I mean, for me, it was certainly difficult. I spent 5 years trying to get a grant, and this grant was the NSF Antarctic Artists and Writers Grant, which is amazing because it's a grant that, you know, they send artists and writers down to Antarctica and they get to explore and do a bunch of awesome stuff. And so I figured, well, this might be, you know, my really good shot because I went to art school. And even though I do all the sciencey stuff now, you know, I still do artsy stuff as well. So I applied for this for 5 years and I finally got it. So my path was a little bit strenuous.
But I mean, that doesn't sound... It doesn't, like, I know a lot of people apply a lot to get to go just for any period of time. So, like, what was your pitch? Were you I'm going to go down and document stuff. I'm going to make art with things that are only available, materials that are only available in Antarctica.
Yeah, so my whole pitch was looking at life underneath the ice, the microbial life beneath the ice. And so I was working with ice divers who were getting samples for me from the seafloor. I was working with researchers. We hiked up a glacier and we got to drill into the top of a glacier. And, like, I got to look at the microbes that live on tops of glaciers and frozen lakes and subglacial pools and all these different locations. And this is my pitch, was the fact that a lot of people, when they think about Antarctica, they think it's, you know, barren and lifeless, except for maybe penguins. And so I really wanted to showcase how Antarctica is kind of an oasis or a Serengeti of life, and show all of the life that actually exists there. So what I was doing was actually doing a microscopy of all of these different little microorganisms and doing video microscopy, because there's not a lot of images or videos of what these microorganisms look like in Antarctica.
Well, and because it's isolated from the rest of the world and frozen, there's a lot of stuff there that's very unique, right?
Yeah, I mean, this was the thing that I found so fascinating about actually going to Antarctica, is I think a lot of people make it out to be very exotic and foreign. And I mean, it makes sense because very few people have actually gone there. But it's also a place that's very familiar. You're still on Earth. You're still part of the ecosystem of Earth. And so a lot of the microorganisms there might be specific, you know, subspecies that are specific to Antarctica. But a lot of the things you can find everywhere. So, example, there are tardigrades, also known as water bears, which everyone loves because, you know, they can survive in the vacuum of space and they're cute and they've got little claws.
And they're in Star Trek.
Yeah, and they're in Star Trek Discovery. Yeah, you know, they've blown up in popularity. You can find tardigrades in on the top of a glacier that I went, and in a bunch of different locations in Antarctica. But you can also find them in your own backyard or in sidewalks or anywhere on Earth. And so this is what I sort of really found about being in Antarctica, is on one hand, yes, it's this, like, foreign place and it is very different, but there's also so much about it that's very familiar.
And I think a lot of people associate Antarctica with the remoteness of it, at least, with its how it's presented in popular culture. You know, obviously, like, the base is, you know, like, the thing, you know,
mentioned, right? Everyone has right? told me to watch, and I haven't yet.
And so I would love...
Watch now that you're back.
Yeah, totally. I would love to hear from you about one, what the living conditions and what that base was like, and then two, just the logistics of getting there.
Yeah, that's what I'm curious about. Like, yeah, this I want the space shuttle question. What's it like to be in space, Ariel? What's it like to be in Antarctica?
As I said, it's both, you know, weird and not. I did really relate it a lot to the recent movie that we reviewed on Offworld, First Man, you know, because it's about Neil Armstrong and it's about, like, you know, he's got this whole personal life. And then, like, towards the end of the film, you know, he goes to the moon. And in the entire lead up to that, he's just a guy, you know? And so he lands on the moon and he looks around. And I don't know, I feel like that movie gave, like, a sense of being like, well, this is weird, but I've got work to do, and you know, you just get on with it. And so that was sort of my experience, is like going to Antarctica, and I was like, this is weird. It looks surreal. Everyone's going to think it looks surreal, but I have to go do some microscope work.
And there are hundreds of people alongside on the base doing the work. Right? For them, it's day to day, even though it's in a remote place, just like, you know, the astronauts on ISS. On station, it's also just their job as well.
Yeah, so life actually at McMurdo Station. So McMurdo Station is the United States base. It's the largest base on all of Antarctica. And in the summer, which is when I went, it can host up to 1,000 people. Like, a whole lot of people.
Dang.
Yeah.
But so, I mean, that's still a tiny town by, like, North American,
yes,
standards.
It's way more than The Thing, though. The Thing, you have, like,
well, that's
a dozen or two people. And that's when I think of, like, remote base.
And I was in locations where I was only with, like, 8 people. So okay. When I was in the Dry Valleys, which is a helicopter ride away from McMurdo, these are locations that very few people who go to Antarctica can go. And, yeah, the campsites that I was at, and I was camping like in the valleys of mountains, like, only had 8 people.
Wow.
So for 10 days I was sleeping in 5-degree Fahrenheit weather in a normal camping tent, which was intense. And the camps were like 8 people or so.
You didn't have like special like Arctic or Antarctic tents that are like double insulated or anything like that?
I think, but no. So like,
from
so
REI.
Oh my god, they're just regular camping tents like you would use anywhere else. And what you do to survive is you have a really thick sleeping bag, and in the sleeping bag you've got a fleece liner, and then if you're cold, which I was, I'm always cold, I poured boiling water into 2 different water bottles. I put one of them at my feet, one of them at my chest. Then you go to sleep with your neck gaiter on and your hat, and then you, like,
oh my,
you know,
God,
bury yourself. Sometimes even hand warmers I would have in addition to all of this. And then I would put my parka on top of my sleeping bag on top of all of that. And with all of that, for me, I was just like, okay, now if I just don't move an inch, I'm warm enough.
Oh my God, what a night. Like, oh, that sounds horrible. So, okay, but are you laying on like an air mattress or something?
Because, yeah, so okay. you do have like a little thin layer of air between you and the ground to like also insulate you, which is really important. So, but it's only, you know, that thick.
But so it's tense, not, you're not digging holes in the ground, like caves to hunker into for warmth.
You just use rocks around the area to sort of weigh down the tent, and then, yeah, you drive stakes into the ground.
Wow.
And, you know, normal camping stuff, which is funny because, like, I'm not much of a camper at all. I'm more of a glamper, but, yeah.
So Will's analogy for McMurdo Base, it wasn't 1,000 people. They were up to 1,000.
Up to.
Like a small town, or, as I would think of it, that's
like high school,
the crew contingent of the Enterprise, right?
Yeah.
Right? Or, you know, did it have a small town feel?
It definitely did, but in, I would say, a positive way. So a lot of people equate McMurdo to being like a mining town, and it, certainly in appearance it has that, because, yeah, there's a lot of tractors, there's a lot of like industrial machines around and everything. But, you know, life at McMurdo is actually kind of comfortable, like if you're not doing field work a lot. So, you know, they've got 2 bars, they've got a coffee shop, they've got a huge laboratory, which I worked in, and they've got the galley, which is the big cafeteria where everyone has the same meal times and everything. And so, you know, it's I don't know, it was comfy. And the thing that really struck me about McMurdo the most that I wasn't expecting was just how friendly everyone is. Just everyone is extremely friendly. And I wasn't really expecting that. Not that I thought they were going to be unfriendly, but in a lot of science communities, there's a lot of, you know, prove yourself sort of behavior and things like that. And I just didn't get that at all in McMurdo. Everyone was here in Antarctica and everyone respected everyone else. And it was just really fantastic.
I mean, I have to imagine if you've been there for a while, new faces are really exciting, right? But also, everybody's on the same team there, right? If you're in Antarctica, it's because you're interested in, you know, climate science or disappearing ecologies or, you know, whatever it happens to be. And when you're surrounded by a giant group of really smart people, it's like when you go to a really good conference, it's full of people that are really a lot more interesting than you. You're like, oh man, everybody here I can talk to is really interesting. And I have to imagine it's the same kind of vibe there. Like, I gotta imagine the conversations in the CAF are pretty good.
Yeah, so this is really something no one can relate to except for myself. But when I was there, I was like, oh, it's like getting to spend the night at NASA. It just felt like you get to be in this cool place where everyone is interesting and fascinating and you're there 24/7. And yeah, you get to learn about all this amazing stuff. And this is from the scientists and, you know, the janitors alike, because there are a bunch of people there doing science, but there are a lot of people there just with interesting stories that are working on the wastewater plant or working in the power plant. People who are doing really interesting stuff. And I loved hearing stories about how people found their way to Antarctica. And, it was a broad range.
Mm. It was the summer, so you had the ability to go outside and explore. And in the wintertime, are people basically stuck in the base and with the interconnected hallways and it feels more like isolation?
From what I heard, a lot of the people who do winter overs, so they stay for the full winter, it's definitely a different vibe and it takes a lot of adjustment once the summer months start. So for the winter people, it's definitely much more hermit mode. The winter people have a ton of video games, a ton of DVDs, a ton of stuff that they bring with them. And people kind of keep to themselves and there's no lines because in the winter there's maybe, I don't know, 150 people or so.
Wow.
So it really clears out. So it goes from 900 to 150-ish. And so once the summer starts up, all these people who have sort of been in hermit mode and in eternal darkness, suddenly there's all these people who are like really excited. It's like, right. Who are you? How are you doing? And like, they're a bit like, whoa, like I have to wait in line for food and all these people are too joyful and, you know, stuff like that. So
So you said the people there in the winter have a lot of video games and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. What, like, when you're packing for Antarctica, like, how much stuff do you, like, when you get there, this, like, here's the last person's coat, this one looks like it'll fit you, smack it on, or are you responsible for bringing everything that you're going to need and, like, survival gear and the whole thing?
So, essentially, there is, like, a quartermaster of sorts in New Zealand when you land in New Zealand from the U.S., and they give you all of your external gear. So, they give you a big parka, they give you, you know, some snow overalls. They give you gloves and goggles and boots that are way too huge for everyone and are really cumbersome. But so all your external stuff they give you, they issue you. But everything that goes beneath that, you have to bring yourself. Okay. So you've got to do all your base layers, all your mid layers, you know, everything else, sunglasses, everything like that. And for me, as someone who doesn't go skiing or snowboarding and doesn't go camping, I had to do a lot of shopping before I went and buy a lot of gear that I knew nothing about prior. But now I just had a friend who was going to spend a few days in Antarctica. And I was just like, oh, yeah, you definitely want these socks and you want this base layer pant. And, you know, and so now I feel like I know what to bring.
Is there like a message board or a subreddit or something that like people who like where you can go, like, I mean, because there's no Amazon Prime. You can't, if you forget something, you're kind of boned.
Yeah, so they do have a store where they've got, you know, some clothing there and they've got, you know, various, you know, toiletries and things like that. But, you know, if you need something special or any of your gear that you don't bring, yeah, you are kind of boned. Like, so for me, like on my Favorite Things video, I was talking about a driver kit that had different like screwdriver heads and things like that. And that thing just saved me because I was able to like take apart all of my different devices and I didn't have to go hunting around for the right screwdriver. But stuff like that, yeah, if you don't bring it, you have to get really creative. And that's one of the things that actually I really liked about McMurdo is it's definitely very maker, hacker community. People get creative about how to make do with very little.
Well, speaking of like message boards, is there an intranet? Like, do people on the base communicate with each other and build little communities and to share resources?
Yeah, so let's talk about communication. So there is an intranet in McMurdo, and that's useful. But there's no, you're not allowed to have any internet on your phone unless you're an extremely important person. And I was not extremely important enough to have internet on my phone. And so you are using a lot of 1990s era technology. So you're using a lot of Ethernet to plug your computer in to get internet access. And then everyone has pagers.
Wow.
Yeah. Everyone okay. uses pagers, and like it's really, really, really weird.
Like two-way ones? Like you can type out a little message?
No, they don't have any like things where you can type on it. You can type out a message, I think, if you go through some online source or something. I don't know. Wow. But essentially, they're pagers that have like five buttons on them and nothing more. And
it's
and
the Star Trek communicator.
Yeah.
It's how you get pinged.
But yeah. But what do people just send you an extension number and you go pick up a phone?
Yeah,
and
so
dial
you
it?
So you have a phone like a old school phone in your dorm. You have an old school phone in your office. For me, I had a lab also, so I had an old school phone in my lab, and so all of those have extension numbers. And so then, yeah, if someone needed to reach me and they couldn't reach me at the exact time at the phone, then they would have to page me, and then I would have to go looking for a phone to call them back because there's no cellular service. So yeah, a lot of things are very 90s era tech.
So I know you probably posted pictures of this stuff to your Instagram and Twitter and other places, but what does it when you go to NASA stuff, then you walk around and you're like, oh man, everything seems really clean. And then you get into the places where people actually work, and it feels much more, not quite like a factory floor, but it feels industrial, right? It feels like places that serious work is happening. And I have to imagine, like, McMurdo's been there for a really long time now in different incarnations. Mm-hmm. Like, does it feel like a place that has been there for 40 years, or does it feel like...
I mean, it definitely has. And I would actually say, you know, most government facilities, NASA included, are not like all sleek and clean. Like,
not the way you see in The Martian.
Well, no.
Well, it's like the difference between, like, say, the new mission control in Johnson and the hallway outside mission control in Johnson, right?
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. I mean, it feels like a government facility. Right. So it's like if you're someone who's familiar with what government buildings look like and how opposite of glamorous they are and how outdated and falling apart they are, then you won't be shocked. And so I wasn't shocked, but other people who were not familiar with like working with the government before showed up and they were just like, this is the state of science in our country, like, because things are really falling apart and old. And there are plans to update some of the buildings in McMurdo in the coming years and everything, but you know, it's this government building, so it's kind of, you know, the least they can do. One thing, you know, a lot of I'm understanding of, but one thing that I thought was really ridiculous and definitely like I want to like lobby Congress to fix this because it's so basic. You have dorms and in the summer it's light all times, like 3 a.m, 4 a.m. It's always daylight. The sun never goes down. You would think the most minimum thing that these facilities could do for the dorm rooms is have blackout curtains. They have some slightly thick curtains that don't fully cover the windows. No. And so what people end up doing, who are like people who go every year, they cover their windows with foil. And so you walk around and all these windows and dorms are just covered with foil so people can just actually get a good night's sleep
Elvis
and block out the light.
Too, you know,
no.
When he was on tour. I mean, so you pack your clothes, you pack your science gear. How much, like, do you have a weight? I assume you have a weight allowance because you have to come in by plane, right?
Yeah.
What is it? How much can you carry?
Yeah, so if you don't have an excess baggage allowance, I think it's like only like 85 pounds, which, you know, and a lot of people are there for months. And
That's not a lot.
No, it's not.
It's like a backpacking trip.
So I had an excess baggage allowance because I was bringing down microscopes. So I had $100 extra of baggage that I was able to bring down. But I had to pay some excess baggage fees and things like that. And so, yeah, to make the trip down to Antarctica, because you had asked about that before, you take a plane to New Zealand.
Just a normal commercial plane.
You know, so from San Francisco to Auckland, it's like a 13-hour flight. And then you do a small hop from Auckland to Christchurch. And Christchurch is where everyone out of the United States and the New Zealand Antarctic program deploy out of for McMurdo and the South Pole. And so then you're there, and then you take a military plane from Christchurch into Antarctica, and you land on a snow-packed runway. So on the way there, I took a C-17 military huge jumbo. Wow.
But on the inside, is it decked out to look like a commercial airline?
No.
So you're sitting on the sides of the walls?
Yeah, and, so I sit on the side on the walls, and they had like huge huge pallets of cargo. And so there was only maybe 40 people on my flight or something on the C-17. Massive plane, but it was filled with cargo and filled with.
And it opens up in the back, and
you put on your Halo mask, and the Tom Cruise jumps out and you follow after. Right?
Yeah. So that was actually pretty comfortable, considering on the way back from Antarctica. So coming back, the runways, as the summer goes on, the runways start melting, and then different planes are not allowed to fly in anymore. And so I had to take a smaller plane on the way back, which was a C-130, which is a four-propeller plane.
Vietnam era.
Yeah, definitely. And that one is not made for passengers whatsoever. They've got like cargo netting, and you sort of sit in that. And the difference between the C-17 going down from Christchurch to McMurdo versus the C-130 going back. So on the way there, it was a 5-hour flight. On the way back, because it's this propeller plane, 8-hour flight, eight and a half hour flight.
What are you doing? You're just kind of miserable because
there's no room for anyone to sit. So you've got this netting, and you have to pretty much sit like right next to everyone, even though there's like only like 20, 25 people on the plane. It's just not meant for passengers. And then the first 2 hours, because it's not pressurized, you're really, really cold because you're leaving Antarctica. And then like 2 hours in, I sort of like half woke up, and it was just really freaking hot because you're entering summertime in New Zealand. And so it's like, everyone just started like stripping all of their like exterior wear off. And like, it was just really hot all of a sudden.
Hey everybody, Norm here. And before we continue with this week's episode, I want to thank the sponsor that makes it possible. And that's Ops Genie by Atlassian. Because incidents happen and they require complex coordination between operations and software development teams who are putting out fires every day. That's why getting alerts immediately is critical. Thankfully, there's Ops Genie by Atlassian. Ops Genie empowers dev and ops teams to plan for service disruptions and stay in control during incidents. It also gives teams the power to respond quickly and efficiently to unplanned issues, and helps notify all the right people through a smart combination of scheduling and escalation paths that account for things like time zones and holidays. Better yet, Ops Genie allows for deep flexibility in how, when, and where alerts are deployed, with over 200 integrations like Jira, Amazon CloudWatch, Datadog, New Relic, and more. Plus, it tracks all activity and provides useful insights to improve future incident responses. It's services like Ops Genie that allow the other services that you rely on and you use so frequently, especially during this holiday season, to stay up and running without service interruptions, because those engineers are on it. With Ops Genie, your next incident doesn't stand a chance. Visit OpsGenie.com to sign up for a free company account and add up to 5 team members. That's OpsGenie.com. Never miss a critical alert again with Ops Genie. Now back to the conversation.
Yeah.
So when we're bouncing all over the place here, but I like everything you say makes me think of like 8 different questions. What, when you're in the base, so when you're camping, you said you're kind of cold all the time. Mm-hmm. It's just, there's no campfires because nothing to burn.
No. Yeah.
You have a stove to make boiling water, and that's what can make you warm.
Water,
right.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. Cause I guess you're not supposed to scoop.
Well, so you do get your water from, they call it glacier berries, which are like sort of little outcrops of ice. So you get your ice from, you know, the natural area around. But yeah, you have to have very limited water. So I was in the dry valleys for 10 days and there's no showers.
I mean, at least it's not hot. So
yeah, it's not hot, but you're doing feel like you're sweating.
Yeah.
You're sweating a lot. So it's really, 10 days without like you're hiking up glaciers, you're doing like intense work, and you're not showering for that entire time. And it was
on the base bar. Where did the bar advertise glacier ice, cube ice in the bar.
Yeah, well, I mean, people did make a lot of comments about how, you know, bars would love to have, like, glacier
ice
drinks.
Yeah, thousands of water,
yeah.
Untouched by human chemicals. Mm-hmm. What like in the base, is it cold? Like, is the base like, are you walking around in heavy sweaters and boots and all that inside?
Yeah, so around McMurdo, as I said, like, McMurdo's pretty comfortable. So I got there, you know, at the start of summer, and it was definitely, there were days where it was just like really cold, and the wind always affects how cold it is, 100%. But towards the end, so over a 5-week span, it went from, you know, the ground being utterly frozen and really cold, just miserable days, to at the end of 5 weeks, like, there was water on the ground and sun is out and, like, everything's melting. And so you definitely got the sense of, oh yeah, this is summer in Antarctica. And when it is that warm, some people, not me, but some people consider it t-shirt weather. Just because when there's no wind, even when it, so it's like, if there's no wind and it's like 20 degrees Fahrenheit and there's sun, like, it's actually not that bad. So wind affects everything, but, you know, most of the time, you know, you don't have to wear a big red parka just to dart between buildings and everything. You can just wear jeans or whatever.
It's pretty dry, right? So you're not,
it's very dry.
It's not like you get the humidity sucking all the warmth out of you.
Yeah, it's extremely dry. And I think that was something that really caught me off guard, is that, you know, Antarctica is a desert. It's a polar desert, and it's drier than any regular desert that I've been in, and it ruins your skin, and I had to sleep with a humidifier, which I never do, just to, like, not wake up and feel like my face was concrete every day.
Yeah.
So actually the dryness, like, hits you way more than the cold.
The area around the base, I imagine, is pretty well explored. And so what are the expeditions like when people leave base? How far do they go out? And where are there set destinations people go to, or is there actually new places they go?
Yeah, so usually there's set field camps for a lot of the people who do go off base. So most people stay in McMurdo, and a lot of science is done, like, in the sea ice area and surrounding area, and most of the support staff and everyone stays in McMurdo. But there are set field camps. So in the dry valleys, there's three main camps. There's Lake Bonnie, which has Blood Falls, which is that, like, if you've ever seen a picture of red stuff coming out of a glacier.
Yeah.
There's Lake Hoare, which has
it's algae, right?
Not algae. It's actually iron oxide. They originally thought that it was algae, but it's iron oxide that hasn't hit oxygen for, like, millions of years, and then, like, is just hitting it.
So it's bright red and wow.
There is bacteria living in it, though, which is why it's really interesting to study. So yeah, you've got Lake Bonnie, Lake Hoare, and then Lake Frixel. Those are all kind of right next to each other. And yeah, this area called the Dry Valleys is it's, you know, a 30-minute helicopter ride away from McMurdo. So in one instance, you would think, well, maybe it's, you know, only the most interesting thing, like, close to McMurdo. But it's actually really fascinating for the entire continent. It's the largest area in all of Antarctica that is not covered by ice or snow. The entire continent. And the continent is nearly the size of North America. So you've got this one patch that's near McMurdo that has no ice or snow. And it's really fascinating to go there because you're walking around on all this ice and snow all the time in Antarctica. And you start wondering, like, what does the land itself look like?
Yeah.
Like, what if I could, like, get rid of all the ice and snow and actually see the continent?
It's just a bunch of geologists walking around, I assume.
Yeah. So the dry valleys, you can actually walk on the continent itself, which is what makes it exciting.
Is there fauna? Is it soft? Is it, like, rock?
So there's no you know, trees or anything. You know, there's no plants that are, you know, not microbial. And it is soft, which was the weirdest thing, because I was going there. It's the dry valleys. You're in Antarctica. You expect everything to be frozen solid.
Yeah.
But everything is soft. So you get out of the helicopter in the dry valleys, and your first step, it's, like, squishy, the way sand would be squishy. And it weirded me out because it gives you the feeling that, like, everything's, like, wet, but it's not. What I think is actually happening is the fact that The permafrost doesn't start until like 20 centimeters below or something. And all the rocks and sand and stuff that sits on top never has any moisture. So it never clumps together. So it's just all loose constantly. And so you step on things and your foot like just squishes into the ground everywhere you step. It was really a weird sensation.
Well, because, I mean, there's no biomass to make the soil matrix. So it's just vines and pebbles and stuff, right?
Yeah, like there's some microbes around, but otherwise, yeah, it's very limited. Wow. You don't have like moss or anything.
You want to bring fertilizer out there.
I have to imagine it's like if you filled a bucket with sand and pebble, a bunch of different sized pebbles, and start walking around.
Yeah,
that's really weird.
Yeah, it's weird because it gives you the same feeling as mud or moist stuff, but it's not moist at all. So other locations that people go to are like the South Pole. There's also a really cool location called Waste Divide, which stands for West Antarctic Ice Sheet Divide, where they've got like a 3-story building that they're having to dig out because it got covered all the way to the top with snow. Right now, there is a team out at Lake Mercer, which is a subglacial lake that is not at the South Pole, but it's closer to the South Pole. And they are drilling through to, you know, study what life might live, you know, in this subglacial lake. And
presumably been isolated for millions of years? Or?
Yes, okay. Yeah. Like most of these subglacial lakes are fascinating to study because, they sort of have these ecosystems in them, but they're completely remote from the surface.
Tell us about the underwater stuff.
Yeah, I was going to say I want to hear.
Okay, so the coolest thing to do in McMurdo that anyone can do, you don't have to be a scientist to do this, is there is a thing called the ob tube, which is known as the observation tube. And the ob tube is literally a pipe that is barely the width of a human that they insert into the sea ice. And you can crawl down this pipe and it's, I don't know, it's maybe 3 to 4 times my height or something.
It looked tall enough to be a scary ladder. But
yeah,
not like
it's, yeah.
20
like
feet deep or something.
Yeah, 20 plus feet deep, baby. And you crawl down this like little ladder into this pipe. It looks like from Mario, like you're going down one of the Mario pipes. And then you get down there and there's 360 windows surrounding you. And you get to actually be underneath the sea ice looking at all the sea creatures and the sea floor and everything. So you get to have the same experience more or less as a diver in this little contained thing that you don't have to actually be a diver for. And it was fantastic because prior to going in it, I was like, why would anyone ever be a diver in Antarctica? Like, that sounds miserable and who would dive in, you know, -2 degrees Celsius like water? And then I went into this tube and saw like a glimpse of what they get to see. And I was like, I get it now. Like, this is incredible.
Can you go get that cert and start reapplying?
and divers are on the other side. Like, they're...
Yeah. So if you go at the same time as divers are going down, and I did one time, like, they'll take a selfie with you and they're underwater and they're just swimming up to you. And what's also really cool about it is not only, so you get to see the underside of all the sea ice, you get to see all the fish swimming around, you get to see the sea floor, but also there's seals, there's Weddell seals, and they make sounds that sound like Doctor Who sound effects, I kid you not, and you get to hear them with such clarity in that little ob tube. It's really magical.
How far? Well, wait, questions. How thick is the ice at McMurdo?
So this is why I was trying to look it up because I think I forgot. Like, I want to say, like, some of the ice was like around like 250 centimeters thick. So really,
like 10 feet.
Yeah, like pretty 10, thick. Yeah. And then in other places, maybe it was closer to like 400. I need to look it up, but it's thick that you'd never in a million years have to worry about falling through.
Yeah, I mean, I was just wondering, like, how far below the ice are you when you're in the 20-foot deep tube? And it seems like you're pretty close, but...
Yeah, I feel like if I'm sitting in the ob tube, then, you know, the ice is maybe, I don't know, ice is maybe 15 feet above me or something. And, yeah, and then the sea floor is, I don't know, maybe 30 feet below.
Oh, so it's that was my next question.
Yeah, the sea floor. So I know that the seafloor depth around that area is around 75 feet. So you're sort of suspended in the middle between the sea ice and the seafloor.
How what's the sea life like on the floor under the ice? Like, I assume there's not, like, kelp forests and stuff like that because there's not light
half the year.
There's
a lot of life. There's a lot. You have crinoids, which are those weird little... I don't know.
The wavy things?
Yeah, the wavy things. They go like this.
Okay. For audio listeners, yeah, Ariel's putting her hands at her side and waving back and forth.
Yeah, exactly. I'm doing an awkward flapping. Crinoids are really cool. But no, there's starfish. There's sea spiders. There's crabs in some areas. There's actually, that's why I found it so fascinating. There's a ton of life underneath the sea ice. Oh. A ton. And then on the microbial side, there's tons of just beautiful diatoms, which are single-celled algae that have glass shells, and they come in shapes of triangles and squares and circles, and they're beautiful. Most of the sea life that I had to filter through, which wasn't fun from the seafloor, is a lot of worms, a lot of worms. So it's like I'm getting like these little samples from the divers, and they're filled with mud. And I'm trying to get all this microbial stuff, the stuff you can't see out of it. And I'm like sort of poking it with like a spoon or a knife or something, trying to get some of the mud out. And one time I was poking like this little sample of mud and just I like activated the worms and all these like little worms started like rearing their heads. Oh, God, it was so creepy.
That's awesome. That part sounds like it feels like a science fiction and from another planet.
Yeah, it was gross.
That's great.
That's I mean, we could keep asking questions for hours. Yeah. We'll have to have you back, Ariel, when Adam's back, I think.
And Ariel, I know this is an ongoing project because not only did you document a lot, you film videos of yourself, and you're waiting for samples to come back from the trip to do further work on it. But eventually this stuff will, and your stories will make their way not only on your YouTube channel, but also on your website and the site you're setting up. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll be working on all this stuff for the months to come. And I'm still in the process of actually editing 5 weeks of video from Antarctica. So if anyone is interested in checking it out, you can go to my YouTube channel, Instagram, and Patreon are probably the three best places to find me. And those are all under Ariel Waldman.
Thanks for sending us the postcard from Antarctica, too.
Yeah.
That was really awesome.
I can't wait to hear more. I can't wait to see what the rest of the trip was like. This is amazing. Thanks so much, Ariel.
Well, welcome back. And this will be the final podcast for this year.
Are you sure this time? You told me that last time.
I'm sure this time. We got you on to do the final podcast. So have a happy new year, everyone. You'll be able to find most of our stuff next year on Tested.com. Of course, Will, you can find online at Will Smith.
Yeah.
And at Ariel Waldman for Ariel as well. And we have a show called Off World that Ariel does for us that you can find new episodes starting a new year and subscribe to that as a podcast as well if you're a podcast listener, as we hope you are today. Thank you, everyone out there. Thank you guys both. And see you next time.
Thanks.